Great to be with you over your lunch break, and it must feel sublime and or ridiculous to walk from meetings about mining and government and so on to think about gothic poems of death and destruction. But that's what we're doing, and so if you go back to the office a bit glummer and more morose and teenage-like, then it's we take full responsibility, and CBF will offer you a job if you lose yours with your morose attitude. Now, we did want to think about death in the brief 25 minutes or so we've got together. We won't take more of your time than that. I want to start with a very short poem from the first century about death. It simply says this: I wasn't, I was, I am not, I don't care. It was on a tombstone in the first century, written originally in Latin. I wasn't, I was, I am not, I don't care. That's a particular way of thinking about death, a particular way of framing it, and it comes from the Greek tradition, and those of us, most of us who indwell or at least live in a city that indwells the Western tradition, there are two children within our womb. The Greek rational tradition and then the Judeo-Christian tradition of the revelation of the God of creation. And I wanted to think about three poems of death that to some extent fit within the Western tradition, and particularly within the Christian tradition, though not all written by Christians. And I think they contrast quite sharply in their own way with that attitude to death of the Greco-Roman world. I wasn't, I was, I am not, I don't care. We'll look at three poets that care very deeply about the fact that they or someone they love is dying. The first, I think we've got a picture. Do we have a picture of Dylan Thomas? The first is Dylan Thomas, who I think the dates are, it was his birthday a couple of days ago, and the noting of his death a few days from now. So it seems uncannily appropriate that we think about Dylan Thomas. Dylan Thomas is a Welsh poet born in 1914 into a kind of middle-class Welsh family. Parents were, his father was a teacher. He was an unremarkable student and left school early. I've got a long list of people who were unremarkable students. I found that encouraging for reasons I won't share with you. He was an unremarkable student, but was an early poet, and although having left school early and never gone to university, was quickly published as a poet and developed a reputation as a very individual kind of poet. They tried to categorise him in different schools, but his great hope, although coming from an English-speaking Welsh family, was to be the great Welsh poet, and the debate rages over whether he ever achieved that. Dylan Thomas is one of those people, I guess, that ushers in the 21st century because he's as famous, if not more famous, for his life than for his poetry. So Dylan Thomas was a very heavy drinker, a philanderer, and incurred massive debts over the course of his life. He tried to supplement his income with a broadcasting side business with the BBC, and so to this day you can hear his voice, almost entirely devoid of a Welsh accent, but if you look for it on YouTube, you'll hear his beautiful voice reading his poetry and, you know, Child's Christmas in Wales, perhaps the most famous. He did four tours of the United States and died on his last tour there, and became kind of the paradigm example of the 20th century doomed poet, the one who kind of Kurt Cobain style just ran up debts and drugs, and eventually his life ended. There's some mythology surrounding the end of his life. The famous story is that the last words the bartender heard him say in the pub near the Chelsea Hotel was, I've had 18 whiskies, I think that's a record. And they were apparently the last words that were heard, although there's some dispute over whether the nature of his death and so on. Dylan Thomas didn't, he's probably in some sense like a conventional Christian, but certainly didn't see himself as Christian, and his poetry ranged between kind of traditional Christian themes and more kind of pagan and nature-based themes. God was present in his work, but often present as a kind of nature god, reaching back to a kind of pre-Christian Celtic view and so on. But I wanted to read to you a poem. This is one of his most accessible and straightforward poems. Often Dylan Thomas is quite surreal and obtuse, and it's hard to know what he's talking about, but this poem is very straightforward and very famous. I think it's up there now, and I'm going to have a shot at reading it to you. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day, rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words have forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good men, the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay, rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight, and learned too late they grieve it on its way, do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death who see with blinding sight, blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay, rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night, rage, rage against the dying of the light. You probably worked out some of it, but it's Thomas himself. So Thomas sometimes writes in persona, but here's Thomas as Thomas, Dylan Thomas, speaking to his father, who was on his deathbed. His father had gone blind at this stage and was dying. And you can see in the poem, it's Thomas, the son, trying to persuade his father to rage against dying, to not go gently, to not accept serenely his fate. And the way he tries to persuade his father is to give these other examples of men that have not faced their death with quiet equilibrium. So he has there in the second stanza, wise men at their end know dark is right, that is, the philosophers and the scholars, they know that it's what humans do, we live and then we die. And he says, yet because their words had forked no lightning, I think what he means there is, you know, scholars want and writers want their words to be heard and to bring heaven to earth or to electrify the world with their writing and so on. And so he says that the philosophers, even though they know that that is our fate, when they see that their projects are not finished, that their words haven't set the world on fire, they do not go gently into that good night. They protest the end of their projects. And the third stanza, good men. I think that he probably means morally good men. You know, the moralists, great livers of life in moral ways. He says, those guys, their frail deeds might have danced on a green bay. He said, the last wave by, I think the picture you're supposed to have is of the waves of the sea crashing onto a bay, and that's death, that here come the good men, and they're about to crash and be enveloped by the sand on the sea. But the good men say that their deeds could have danced, and yet they crash, and so they protest as well. And the wild men, I think that's probably Dylan Thomas referring to himself in that kind of the tragic poet, who they see the sun in flight, and they try to grab it, and they grieve it too late on its way. And they too don't go gently into that good night. And then I think he refers to his own father, grave men near death, who see with blinding sight. His father's gone blind. Blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And then directly addressing his father. That I think that fantastic line, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears. That somehow Dylan Thomas thinks that for his father to rage against death would be both a curse but more a blessing to him to hear his father protest his imminent death. I don't know what you make of that, if any of you probably people have been in a situation at the death of a loved one. I was reading D.G. Meyer, who is a literary critic, an Orthodox Jewish literary critic who is dying of cancer at the moment and is writing and speaking quite publicly about his dying from cancer, and he says that he doesn't share this sentiment, but his children do, that his son especially wants him to be less serene about his death, to be less welcoming of his death, and to fight against it. Well, that's Dylan Thomas on death. This is as dark as it gets. We're going from Dylan Thomas to Nick Cave. Nick Cave is an Australian songwriter and actor, but most famous as a novelist and as a, oh, no, no, sorry, most famous as a songwriter and lyricist, but also a novelist actor and so on, and noted for being obsessed with the themes of murder, of love, of violence, and obsessed with the Bible. So his entire kind of corpus is just saturated with biblical imagery. He was born in 1957 in rural Victoria, and was exposed to Christianity as a child, especially when he was age 9. He joined the cathedral choir in rural Victoria. I can't remember the name of the town. And through that began a lifelong obsession with the Bible, and especially with the Old Testament. When he was 19, he'd moved down to Melbourne to pursue his career and so on, and he was getting bailed out of the St Kilda police station for burglary and by his mother, and then they both heard there and then the news that his father had died in a car accident. He later recalled, he said, "My father died at a point in my life when I was most confused. The loss of my father created in my life a vacuum, a space in which my words began to float and collect and find their purpose." Nick Cave kind of represents a gothic tradition in popular music, and is a notorious drug user and drinker. And so it's often surprising to read in interviews that he repeatedly identifies himself as a Christian. Maybe not the kind of Christian you'd get to run your Sunday school program, but someone who has regularly talked about his belief in God, a bit like Bob Dylan. He leaves a really mixed message from interview to interview, but does regularly talk about his belief in God. He kind of lived in the Old Testament, and then he met an Anglican minister one day who really said, "You ought to keep going and read the New Testament part of the Bible." And Nick Cave asked him, "Which part should I read?" And he said, "The Gospel of Mark." And he read the Gospel of Mark and just became absolutely enchanted with what he saw there. He loved it, and he loved it so much that actually there was a secular American publishing company who were publishing parts of the Bible in those little black editions, and they got Nick Cave to write the foreword to the Gospel of Mark. And he found the energy of Jesus. He said he grew up in an Anglican church, and he described it as kind of decaf Christianity, Christianity without any caffeine in it. And he said the Gospel of Mark was full of caffeine. Because there you met a Jesus who was surprising and scary and bold and brave and dangerous and entirely attractive. So that's Nick Cave and his strange relationship with the Christian faith. But I'm going to share with you this very dark but interesting song. It's called The Mercy Seat, and bear with me. It began It began when they come, took me from my home and put me on death row, of which I am nearly wholly innocent, you know. I'll say it again, I am not afraid to die. I began to warm and chill to objects and their fields, a ragged cup and a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup, those sinister dinner meals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, a hooked bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this measuring of truth, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And anyway, I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. Interpret signs and catalogue, a blackened tooth, a scarlet fog, to be done with all this measuring of truth. Can you work out from which perspective you're speaking? What's this about? Anyone want to hazard a guess or bring back a memory? Obviously, it's kind of a gothic theme. It's a person on death row, so it's in the first person, from a criminal who's about to face the electric chair. But Nick Cave does this. You can see that there, the picture of a death row hospital, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, the sinister meals. You know, there's photographs on the internet of the last meals of people on death row, and he picks up that kind of horrendous image, and he talks about the mercy seat is waiting. And the mercy seat in this song means at least three things. It refers to the Ark of the Covenant in the Old Testament, where the people of Israel had the Ark in which they carried the Ten Commandments and so on, and they talked about the mercy seat, the place on the Ark where God and humanity met in atonement and in mercy. And that's the mercy seat. And the mercy seat is also the cross of Jesus, the point where atonement is made between God and man. And the New Testament takes the Old Testament image of the mercy seat and applies that to the cross of Jesus. But here, it's also the electric chair itself as the place that he talks about as the mercy seat. He goes on in this and talks about Christ, how Christ was born into a manger, and like some ragged stranger, he died upon the cross. And might I say, it seems so fitting in his way. He was a carpenter by trade, or at least that's what I'm told. In heaven, his throne is made of gold. The Ark of the Testament is stowed, a throne on which I'm told all history does enfold. Down here, it's made of wood and wire, and my body's on fire. It's a horrific picture of the mercy seat in heaven, which holds out the hope of atonement, but the same image applied to this wooden and wired chair, which is the place where the criminal hopes he might find atonement. It's about, I think, as dark a poem as you can possibly get, but I think it kind of captures Nick Cave's kind of old journey from the Old Testament as he understands it to the New Testament as he understands it, as he kind of almost in a strange and creepy way follows the way the story of the Bible resolves itself in the death of Jesus as a place where paradoxically death, the death sentence, issues a life sentence and a place of mercy. In the couple of minutes that remain, I want to do one more poem, which is, this is John Donne, perhaps the one that most of us here, many of us would already know. John Donne's a guy whose life kind of plays in two halves. So the first half of his life is a big spending, he's Roman Catholic and he's sleeping with a lot of women. In the second half of his life, he's Anglican, he's the Dean of St Paul's Cathedral and is writing pious poetry. So very much a game in two halves. But the centre point of his life against which those two halves play is that kind of philandering John Donne, who writes the poems that maybe you giggled about in high school with their kind of sexual imagery. He then marries Anne Moore. They have 12 children, two are stillborn and three die before they're 10, and she dies after 16 years of marriage, and 12 of those 16 years are just having child after child after child. And as you can imagine, that has a sobering effect on someone's view of the world. He converts to the Protestant faith, to the Anglican church, and spends the rest of his life preaching still famous sermons and writing still famous poems. And this is our last poem. Death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those whom thou think thou dost overthrow, die not, poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me. From rest and sleep, but which thy pictures be, much pleasure then from thee, much more must flow. And soonest as our best men with thee go, rest of their bones and souls deliver. Thou art slave to fate, chance, kings and desperate men, and dost poison, worry and sickness, with poison, war and sickness dwell, and poppy or charms can make us sleep as well, and better than thy stroke, while swellest thou then. One short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die. You can see there he's done what many people have done, which is to personify death as a character in the story, and he teases and taunts death as a defeated and weak enemy. Death, be not proud, is the opening line, as he kind of has the voice of a chastising boarding school mum. Death, back in your seat, back in your box, and goes through all the failures of death, its claims to mighty might and dreadfulness. But he says that, you know, from rest and sleep, there but pictures of thee, much more pleasure than from thee, much more must flow. That is, you know, we get a little bit of pleasure from sleep. How much more pleasure will we get from the sleep of rest? Or he says, you know, death's great claim is that it lays us down, but he says that poppy, that is the drugs, or charms can make us sleep as well, that death's claim is not so unique, other things can do it too. But the last line, and the most profound line, I think, one short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more, death thou shalt die. You know, if you go back to that our beginning bit with the poem on the inscription, I wasn't, then I was, now I'm not, I don't care. It's a protest poem, but it's kind of a resigned protest poem. And what the death and resurrection of Jesus do is turn our protest at death into a full frontal assault against death and everything it stands for. Richard Dawkins talks about his little definition of religion, or one of the purposes of religion, is that it's there to bring us peace with death. And in a way, if that's true, the Christian religion kind of missed the memo. Because Christian religion, the Christian faith, the Christian hope is not about peace with death in the sense that we accept it as as part of the cycle, as a natural part of life. We're much more with Dylan Thomas. We rage against the dying of the light. Because the resurrection of Jesus is not a reconciliation to death, but it's overthrow. It's destruction. Passage from the New Testament there, from the Apostle Paul, says the last enemy to be destroyed is death. And the Christian faith and the Christian gospel invites us into something that I think we feel quite deeply, that death is an enemy, a stranger, something that if it could be defeated, it ought to be defeated. Because it destroys our projects, it breaks our relationships. And at the heart of the Christian gospel is not our reconciliation to death, but the overthrow of death in the resurrection of Jesus. Thanks for your time. I hope you're not too miserable back at work. I'm happy to talk and ask questions, but I realise it's nearly time for us to formally finish. Thanks.